Welcome to the NDTI podcast series, Talking Inclusion. My name's Drew Edwards, and today we're talking about inclusion and what it means post-lockdown. I'm joined by Becky Morgan, the Partnership Development Manager for Torbay, working across adult social care, and Alice McColl from NDTI, who is the Development Lead for Children and Young People. Welcome, both of you. We also have a fantastic blog from Ruth, a young person from one of our programmes. So if I could start with you, please, Becky, just to explain a little bit about your work.
Hi, Drew. So my role is very much focused on trying to support the development of partnerships, both between community voluntary organisations within that sector, and also between statutory and community partners.
And Alice, you're working on a really interesting project at the moment, aren't you? If you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, so we've been fortunate in getting funding from the National Lottery Community Fund for Time to Talk Next Steps. And it's a unique programme for 16 to 25 year olds with additional needs across England who are socially isolated and who, for whatever reason, may be feeling stuck and possibly without hope or certainly without aspirations for the future.
Thank you, Alice. That's really pertinent to what we're talking about today, which brings us on to my first question. In your experience, what can stop people being included in their community? So if I could bring you in first, please, Becky.
I think there are a number of factors why people maybe feel that they aren't or can't be included in their community. A lot of it will be to do with confidence and actually feeling safe and able to go out and meet people and join community spaces. So it's really important that we make them as welcoming as possible for people, but also that where people might be in that position, that we find other ways to reach them to help them create some sort of network of support so that they then feel able to go out into the world and participate and contribute. And we've done a lot of that in Torbay through having our community builders and wellbeing coordinators who work closely with statutory services and community partners. So as much as possible, we can identify people who might need that support to engage with their community in various ways. A lot of the time, there is also a challenge in terms of people knowing what's available to them in the community that they might enjoy. Everything's on social media and the internet now, but not everybody has access to that. In Torbay, we have particularly low levels of literacy, low levels of access to the internet, perhaps compared to the national average. And so again, it's about how people can have access to information about things they might want to engage with, rather than just relying on social media and stuff like that.
And are the experiences the same for children and young people, Alice, or are there different issues at play here?
For children and young people and their families, the whole nature of being excluded as a result of difference and needs and labels is what can prevent them being included in their community. And that can go right down to early years where children who have specific needs or developmental needs that are identified early become swiftly labelled and separated, and as indeed their families might do, into specialist support. And equally for children as they grow up and go through education, there is more and more emphasis in schools on difference and labelling, which can mean that children and young people don't have enough opportunities to grow up alongside each other with that acknowledgement that difference is important, that everyone has unique experiences and needs, and that we all have equal value.
And also, I think from the feedback that I've had from community partners and residents, it's really important that we try to make activities in the community as inclusive and intergenerational as possible. So not everybody who is, you know, older wants to mix with just older people. Similarly, if people are younger, everyone is unique and different, and actually there's a huge amount to be gained from that intergenerational connection of learning from each other, breaking down barriers and assumptions about other groups of people who live in the community. And often what we found is that, particularly in the way that funding works, projects are very limited to a specific cohort of residents, which can actually be counterproductive, I think. So one of the things that we're very focused on is trying to increase that inclusivity and intergenerationality, so that it's not just about people engaging with activities that keep them busy, but actually bringing the community together and trying to break down some of those barriers.
That's really interesting. And obviously with lockdown and the several lockdowns that we had last year, that must have been quite challenging if you weren't trying to rely on social media and people being online. How did you overcome that during that period?
We recognise that the community organisations closest to where people live will probably have the best intelligence around people who might need support or help. But there are a lot of people who maybe don't fall into any particular category who've really struggled. And actually people who would never be known to services, who, you know, may seem to have everything perfect in their lives, but they've really struggled. The community itself created a helpline, which was run by lots of different community partners who just came together and said, we need some way of people just having someone to talk to, someone to offer some reassurance, who could maybe connect them to support that they needed. That was advertised through leaflets. Things went through doors. Things went in sort of local press and free newspapers. So it really has to be multifaceted. You have to use every avenue, every network, every bit of intelligence available. And also what has helped is the collaboration between those community partners. The way you reach people is through the relationships. You can have systems and processes, but the relationships have to underpin all of it. Otherwise, people will more likely fall down the gap. And we, you know, there probably were people that we still didn't reach. But I think working collaboratively and having that network and that intelligence that's shared, working as one, really, that was probably the best way for us to reach people that needed support. And that continues now.
So what we're talking about here is allowing communities to do what they do best. Were there challenges around doing that?
Yes, absolutely. There are huge challenges, and there remain challenges. You know, there's a huge sort of cultural barrier that you need to overcome, a mindset barrier. There are histories with relationships which can sometimes get in the way. We've been very fortunate in Torbay because we've had the Ageing Well programme through Torbay Community Development Trust. That's been going on for over 5 years. So a lot of that relationship building was already there. There was a good foundation. And similarly, in social care, we were involved with community-led support for 18 months before COVID struck. So in a statutory voluntary relationship perspective, we'd also done some of the groundwork there. So having that really did help. But absolutely there was a lot of challenge in terms of trying to make that work. People were very fearful. So it was about how do you make sure that people feel supported and safe in what they're doing. Things like volunteer capacity, it is a problem, because if you want to do all these things, you know, and it's community led, you can't just rely on the same few people because they get burned out very easily, especially in such a stressful situation. So it was about how do we attract other people who wouldn't normally be involved in this work to get involved. And the Community Development Trust did a fantastic job of that, campaigning and recruiting for people who were on furlough and so on to get involved in the community support effort. And a lot of those people have continued to do so because they've realised the benefit of doing it. And also others who perhaps receive support in that way. So I know there's a gentleman who was very distressed, and he received really person-centered support through the helpline and was connected to the things that he needed. And he decided that it was so beneficial to him that he wanted to then work on the helpline and become a befriender. And I think quite a few examples of that have happened. The statutory sector very much has to take a servant role in that dynamic and not be dictating how things happen or controlling things, but it's about saying to the community partners, do you know what, in this situation you're much more responsive and creative than us. What is it that you want to do that will meet the community's outcomes, and what do you need from us? What are the blocks? What are the challenges? And then we go away and do what you want us to do. And it's definitely influenced the strategy and the approach that we're taking going forward now, because it would not have, if we'd have tried to control things, it wouldn't have turned out as well as it has done.
So, Alice,
we've had a really interesting blog, which I know you know of, from Ruth, who has talked about, in her opinion, what that looks like. Are there particular pieces in there that resonate with other people that you've worked with on the Time to Talk programme?
Yes, definitely. I mean, Ruth is a young person with a hidden disability and has been able to voice, as a result of the confidence that she's gained through the programme, voice more clearly her own frustrations and difficulties with how difficult it is to fit in, if you like. She describes society as being somewhere that expects people to behave in a certain way to be normal, and that differences, instead of being celebrated or indeed recognised and acknowledged as important, they're seen as weaknesses. And that's a really fundamental issue for many of the young people that we've gradually got to know through Time to Talk Next Steps. When we started the programme, we were all in lockdown, and many of us were reeling from the implications of being cut off, if you like, and isolated at home. What was really pronounced was how many young people we met through Time to Talk for whom lockdown made no difference. That life had not changed for them. They had been that isolated and at home long before the pandemic. And that, I think, is a really important reflection of how uninclusive many of the community activities and services can be for these young people.
So what have we learnt from lockdown, do you think?
We've learnt some very basic things around how it is possible to engage with people and build relationships online. And certainly, where this particular group of young people's, they're more familiar perhaps with being online than they are in terms of face to face. So, you know, and we found many young people choose not to speak at all, but to use text and chat to communicate with us. We've also learned that inevitably young people have lost independent skills that they might have been developing prior to not being able to attend other activities and venues and education settings. And that can create a really complicated issue in families. So we've also had feedback through Time to Talk from parents and carers and siblings who've really noticed an improvement in family relationships as a result of having access to an independent supporter from outside a family who's really focusing in on the interests and the strengths of a young person first and foremost, and putting aside all those deficit model labels that very often they feel they have been required to have in order to access services.
And that's something that, as Becky has said, there are many people that will fall through those gaps. I mean, what we're talking about generally with either age group is people, whether you're young or old. If you are feeling isolated within your community, but don't fit into any particular bracket of support, how do we reach those people?
I think building up different avenues to reach people is very important, and starting where they are at themselves. That's why the interests bit is so important, because where a young person may have very low confidence and may not even say that they have any interests, you'll know that actually it's perfectly possible through developing a trusting and informal and engaging interaction with them in a way that suits them. So it might be on WhatsApp, might be through pictures, it might be through watching YouTube, it might be all sorts of different ways to communicate with young people. Then you find their interests and you build on those. What's been exciting and refreshing is bringing the voice of young people into how services are planned, because once they're planned based upon young people's views, then they're going to be far more successful.
As we come out of crisis, how do we stop people falling back into those gaps?
My personal perspective is actually, first and foremost, that statutory services absolutely have to not fall back into their old ways of being. And, you know, we've got huge backlogs in terms of services. There's a lot of pressure. There might be financial implications going forward for the country, and that might affect things. And actually, then the tendency for statutory services is often to revert back to a much more top-down way of doing things. We have to recognise that the way of doing things through COVID has worked much better, and the possibility and opportunity that brings for everybody, we cannot lose that. And that includes recognising that dedicated resources required if you want to work as a whole community, as a whole system. That doesn't just mean dumping stuff onto the community. It doesn't mean, okay, off you go, here's a bit of money and then off you go. It's actually, no, we need to put resource and time and effort into those relationships so that it does feel like a partnership. Certainly with things reopening, what we're really trying to do here in Torbay is really push that place-based approach. So look at particular neighbourhoods. What does that community need? Regeneration, trying to get them involved. So, for instance, we've started some work on a particular neighbourhood in Torbay, and working with the local community to say, what do you want your space to look like? What do you want your environment to look like? What is it that's important to you that would make a difference to your life first and foremost, and then actually do it, follow it through?
I think one other thing to always remember is the echoes that we've heard a lot through the pandemic of how important community is on a very local basis for all of us, where many of us have developed neighbourhood groups or knowledge of our neighbours that we didn't previously have. We've had conversations in a way that we haven't done before about mutual support. And those things don't need to be services. They don't need to cost money. They need people's attitudes to be open and for the considerations of those who are supporting families, like parents and carers, but also for those children to feel part of those conversations. I mean, I'm a play worker by origin, and I will always go back to how significant street events and open access, inclusive events that include people in community venues, well, roads, basically, street parties, can engender really simple but incredibly significant inclusive activities in communities. And we mustn't forget those. We need to celebrate them, but also make them more available to families. Just going back to the young people I mentioned at the beginning, just how cut off many of them can be. And it's not straightforward to engage necessarily, to engage them in community activity without some additional tailored person-centered support that's going to bring up their confidence enough for them to feel that they can put their head above the parapet and look around and actually develop their aspirations and things are possible.
And that leads us on really nicely to some of the brilliant things that Ruth put up about how we can do things differently, what we can do differently to change the position that we're in at the moment and how we can make things more inclusive.
Yeah, she gave some great examples of from her own experience at primary school, actually, of how, you know, one teacher had read a bit more about autism and had done some really careful work to create a space that she could use for breaking away and having a bit of time out. And that care and attention by that teacher, as much as the practical things that that teacher put in place, is something that she's held on to and is referencing now as a young woman entering into adulthood and thinking about just what it is that's needed to include other young people. So thinking about those, I say small, but sometimes they're not straightforward activities or actions that individuals can take in this case, in schools, in primary, the earlier the better. Affording people, children time to discuss difference and being accepting of difference and celebrating friendships between children of all backgrounds. I think that's a fundamentally important area that we are in danger of prescribing into the equal ops category without properly looking at how culturally it needs to happen across the whole way in which children are watching adults talk to each other and are encouraged to play together, learn together. And Ruth gives some really lovely examples of ways in which she has been supported. And what I thought was particularly useful was her reflections on how the alternative is to be sort of isolated and pulled out in class and sort of made to feel different in front of others. She says here, in primary school, my year six teacher used to call me out in front of the class for having a face like thunder. Mm. I didn't realise that I was scowling. And now we can probably identify that that was an autistic trait and I wasn't very good at masking at that time. And at the time, it made me feel very isolated. So the teacher was doing something that really made her feel isolated, but also exacerbated bullying and discrimination from other children. Mm. And I think it's useful to just note that, you know, statistics state that disabled children aged 10 to 15 are almost twice as likely to be victims of crime than other children. So we're really looking at some serious sort of issues around the role of adults in not just preventing bullying, but modelling accepting inclusive behaviour that acknowledges everyone's difference. One of the extremely exciting areas that's new is around peer support and properly looking at what different ways, the way that young people can connect with each other, support each other, and the different ways that that can play out. So not that traditional necessarily going to a group and doing activities alongside each other, much though that's got a lot of value for many people. But possibly we have some young people who want to become experts by experience themselves and who are feeling confident enough to start exploring just how significant their own story is to influencing change. And I think that's extremely exciting, because the more people we can support to be in that position of strength and advocating, if you like, for other young people, that's when we'll see some real transformative change. Many of the children and young people that we've met both through our programme Time to Talk, but also preparing for adulthood, we have a small helpline, and occasionally young people contact us individually to ask for advice about their next steps and finding their way into training and employment. And it's really notable how many of them may start a conversation listing their labels and diagnoses, because they've become so used to having to do that in order to be heard. And so our work is about rights and strengths. It's not about labels and deficits. Mm-hmm. And the more young people start to really believe that with us, that's when we start to see some really significant changes for them as individuals, but also for, I think, for society. How much richer is life if we can live alongside others with differences and learn from them? And what you'll know is that our systems segregate children and young people very early. And I think that's one of the areas that we need to challenge consistently when we're talking about inclusion, is that that exclusion, those segregated specialist settings, the labels, all of that is something that chips away at people's confidence as they're growing up and leads them to be in that state of isolation as young adults with very little hope, because they don't. They've never been made to feel like they're going to fit in, so why bother?
Some of the things Ruth said about the toys and the books, are amazing. They're absolutely amazing. And things that I think we could have all, I mean, my own children who are now in their 20s could have really benefited from those growing up, would have made my job as a parent so much easier. What's been your favourite thing that you've seen over this period of time, or that you're looking forward to being involved in the development of it? What's been the most exciting thing?
I think for me, it has been a feeling of casting off some shackles of control, casting off those kind of statutory shackles, actually, and the trust and the relationships and the sense of camaraderie almost that's developed, that has been wonderful. It's led to so much creativity, it's led to collaboration. You can see how people have communicated with each other and stopped problems from happening or come up with really creative solutions. So I would say that, you know, actually, I think we need to value what goes on in the community far more and make effort to actually expose ourselves to that. And I don't mean research, I mean go out and meet the people, go out and have a cup of tea with them and see what goes on and see how people are flourishing.
That's great. And that leads into what we'll be talking about in the rest of the series of these podcasts, where we show how people are flourishing, and we'll have some more examples of that. We also have another podcast series called Lives Included, which starts next week, which gives in-depth examples of how people are achieving their included lives and some of the barriers that they've overcome. So thank you both for your brilliant insights, and thank you, Ruth, for your blog, which is available to read under NDTI's news section at www.ndti.org.uk. We'll see you again in 2 weeks' time for the next episode.